We have a similar format to the quizzes. I have another quiz for you today. Quiz number two to help out for the exam. With all the information available, how are you going to study for the lecture exam? What are you going to do to prepare? I would approach the questions and the outlines as your objectives. Those are the objectives for each section. What's meant by origin insertion? What are verses? Well, I'm not going to ask that. What are this? What are that? If you know what are this and what are that, you're ready for an exam. Should you go to the textbook and read it from cover to cover?
No.
And why would you not do that?
It's
a waste of time. What would you use the textbook for? To find out what the eponymium is. To find out what the perimysium is. And where did you find those terms? On the PowerPoint slides and the outline. That's your main guide. Now those are the objectives for the course. The objectives for your course and for each topic are in the form of questions that are inserted into the lecture outlines and the PowerPoint slides. I wouldn't say that reading the textbook is a waste of time, but you're going to find lots of words in the textbook. Let's use one. Longhorn cell. What in the world? Longhorn cell. What in the world? Longhorn cell. My point is there's all kinds of words and terms in the textbook that are irrelevant to this course. I mean, you're going to spend time memorizing and learning them? How are you going to use your textbook? Tell me how you do. You open it up and then what do you do? How do you do that? Take the textbook and there's the perimysium. Now, how are you going to use the textbook to study perimysium?
The index.
The index. When you open your textbook, you open to the back section. It says index, and you look for the term. That's the quickest way to do it, using the index. Or if you were an anal student like I was, I had to read the textbook from cover to cover. But, <no. laughs> but you don't have to do that. Yeah, it's the outlines and the PowerPoint slides that are your guide. Now, the quizzes that you receive, it's got some questions in there that are a little harder than you're going to encounter on the full-blown exam. And they're made harder so that you have to think harder as a group. The concepts will be the same, it's just that some of the questions are a little more difficult on the quizzes. Any other questions about that? Yep. Please use the questions on the PowerPoint slides as your objective and the lecture outline of PowerPoint. Same stuff. Same question. And, of course, the quizzes are useful, too, because you can go through the quiz questions and look at the distractors and say, well, this is not the answer because blah, blah, blah. Oh, A is the answer because, and when I write the question, I'll take maybe D or C, which was the wrong answer, and now I'll write a new question where it's the right answer. But please look at those distractors and understand where they fit in the story and why they are wrong. It's much more important to know why the wrong answers are wrong in the quizzes, and why the right answers are right. Because there's only one right answer, and there's four wrong answers. So make sure you look at those distractors carefully. I forgot to bring the quiz down with me, so I'll go up during the break and get it. We were talking about skeletal muscle, and our task for the week is skeletal muscle and neural tissue. So we'll try to get through most of muscle today and most of skeletal muscle. We'll do nerve.
I just
want
to go through the muscle.
The exam will go through everything that we cover the day before the exam.
Okay.
Well, let's stop learning stuff.
On the after
that, so you don't have any more learning. That's right, because the learning objective questions are the ones that are right in the body. Yes, generally, we strive for a division in histology class. For the first half of the course is tissue. And for the midterm exam, we want to ask questions about tissue, every tissue. And in the second half of the exam, second half of the quarter is all about organs. Mm-hmm. So in laboratory right now, you're studying tissues. And when the lab exam comes around, the question on the little card next to the microscope says, what is the tissue? Or sometimes what's at the end of the pointer. How do you think the questions are going to be in lab in the second half of the course? What's the organ? Correct. What's the organ you're looking at? Yes. So the emphasis now is on tissue. Go to the front of your lab guide, and there's some examples of what sort of questions, or I should say the wording of the question that you might encounter on the lab exam, and it gives you some hints on what the words mean on that little index card that will be right next to the microscope. If the question says, what is the tissue, then you better have epithelium, connective tissue, muscle, or nerve in your answer, because those are the tissues. If the question says, what is the structure, then don't put down as an answer a tissue. You don't want to do that because you get it wrong then. What's the structure? What's the tissue? They're very different. But your lab manual has all that sorted out for you on the very first page of the lab manual. Some practice with it. And you'll have practice. Your TAs put together the practice quiz, the practice lab exam. Yeah, they're working on that here. I'll get that information to you tomorrow. Okay, are we ready?
We're ready.
Okay. So how many different kinds of muscle cells do we have?
Three.
And why are they different, do you think? What makes them different? Function, that's one thing.
Structure.
And structure. Structure and function are different. And we're going to spend a good bit of time talking about skeletal muscle, and then we'll see how cardiac muscle differs in structure and function. And we'll kind of gloss over smooth muscle in here, but in the laboratory, you'll spend a little bit more time on smooth muscle. So we've got a ways to go here in muscle. It's a big section. We were talking about what holds muscle cells together, and this stuff is connective tissue, which holds all cells in an organ together. And we see that the histologists have identified three regions of specialized connective tissue, and so they're given three different names. And we said that epimysium was the shiny surface of a muscle that you encountered in the cadaver lab as you're approaching the muscles in the leg. And there you called it the deep fascia. Shiny collagen-containing deep fascia. The histologists call it the mesium on the epi. Where's the epi? Above, the mesium on the outside, the mesium on the above, or the outside. And then we said that around each muscle cell, deep inside, and inside is called endo, that inside myo, inside, deep inside the muscle, the biceps muscle, or the sartorius muscle, deep inside the muscle is a loose connective tissue that surrounds every single individual cell. Call that endomysia. And that left us then with the perplexing one, the paramecium, which is peri around something, and it turned out to be, paramecium turned out to be around a bundle, a thickening of the connective tissue around a bundle of muscle cells, and you can count them there, there's quite a few of them. And this paramecium you can easily see if you're a meat eater, a steak eater, you can see it on a plate and you're eating your T-bone or your rib steak or your plate. All these paramecial connective tissues show up. You can't see the muscle cells as you're eating, but you can see the paramecium and sometimes the epimecium. Will you see paramecium as you're dissecting in the growth lab? Not likely. Because unless you cut across the belly of the muscle, then you might. And you certainly aren't going to see endomysium in the growth lab because clearly you need a microscope for that to happen. Let's see. Let's use screen for the endomysium around every single muscle cell. Keeps them in their proper position. Any questions about those? Right here. Okay, let's move on then and look into one fascicle. Let's see what one fascicle is all about. Well, there are muscle cells, multiple muscle cells in a fascicle. 15, 5, 100, 400, depends upon the muscle, multiple cells. And this always confused me as a student, and hopefully it doesn't confuse you. Muscle cells by many people are called muscle fibers. That just doesn't jive well with me at all, because what's a fiber in histology that you know now? Collagen fiber. Collagen fiber is all extracellular collagen. Collagen fibers are dead stuff, extracellular material. But a muscle cell is living cytoplasm. And all it does is confuse the student. So a muscle fiber and a collagen fiber aren't even close. And of course it's called a fiber because a muscle cell is long and thin, like this. We'll look at this model of a muscle cell here a little bit more later. What else we're going to find? We're going to find endomysium, loose connective tissue holding the cells together. And what sort of components would you find in the endomysium? If, in fact, it is loose connective tissue, like in studies, what would you expect to find in endomysium since it's loose, areolar connective tissue? Fibroblasts, I like that. Collagen fibers, reticular fibers, everything you studied, macrophages, everything that constitutes loose connective tissue, any other place in the body. Now, this connective tissue kind of holds the adjacent cells in the proper position, but endomysial connective tissue also holds capillaries in place, which are tiny blood vessels, the tiniest blood vessels. These are the ones that are small enough, so that oxygen and carbon dioxide and nutrients can diffuse across the simple squamous epithelium of that capillary. Very, very thin. And here's where gas exchange and food and waste exchange goes on. And hopefully you'd expect to find nerve endings. Nerve fibers, or that word fiber again. Nerve endings, and what would those nerves be doing running through the connective tissue of the endomysium? What's their function? To supply the muscle, sure. To make the muscle work, yes. To make the muscle contract. So all of those things could be seen. You're not likely in lab to find these because they are so small, but you will find these. You'll find capillaries, not easy to see because the simple squamous tubes are very, very tiny. But still easier to see than the nerve endings. Okay, let's move into the individual cell then. The individual muscle cell, and we said that an individual muscle cell is shown right here. We were talking about the fascicle here before. But we're going to talk about these little threads here that are sticking up in the drawing here. And they're a component of each individual muscle cell, and you see they're called myofibrils. Does that term make sense to you, or is it totally confusing? What part of it should make sense to you?
Myo.
And if this is called a muscle fiber, then why do they call these muscle fibrils? Because they're a component of a fiber. Remember, collagen fiber is made up of smaller things called fibrils. Same here, the muscle fiber is made up of some smaller units, some of which are called myofibrils. So, we're gonna look at the interior now in some drawings on the board here and on the PowerPoint slide. The first thing we want to ask is, since these are cells, what do you know about the nucleus? Is there one nucleus? How many nuclei would be in this muscle cell here? Hold that one right there. Hold it there. How many nuclei would be in that single cell? Thousands of nuclei. Thousands, obviously. About 50 to 100 nuclei for what length? For 1 millimeter? 1 millimeter. So then each nucleus is, each individual nucleus is not special, but the fact that there are many of them. Now these myofibrils, of course, are some important functional subunits of the muscle fiber, so we have to look carefully at their arrangement. And we sometimes refer to these myofibrils as an organelle in the cell, in the same fashion that we refer to as the Golgi apparatus and the endoplasmic reticulum. But they're not membrane. They're part of the cytoskeleton of the cell. What other organelles would you expect to find in this long muscle cell here?
Mitochondria.
And how about the organelle that's making the protein of the myofibrils? What about the organelle that makes protein? Would you find that in a muscle cell? Now, would it be ribosomes or would it be rough ER? Would it likely be rough endoplasmic reticulum? And why not? Because these proteins are not being made for what? Export. They're being made for the use of the own cell. There is some rough ER, though, and there's some ribosomes. There's a lot of mitochondria. There's even a little bit of Golgi apparatus for some strange reason inside the cell. So these are all other organelles, but the one we're going to focus our attention on is a very, very intricate cytoskeletal component. So here's our first view then of skeletal muscle. It's not quite It's not quite what you're going to see in lab, because this is the optimum image. You have to look around quite a long time in a number of different slides to find something as good as this. It just happens that the muscle cells were arranged in a perfect longitudinal direction when the knife cut through them. And so if this is a muscle cell, the knife went perfectly through one end to the other. Trouble is, most of the time the knife goes through the muscle cell obliquely. Most of the time the muscle cell is not cut like that, but most of the time it's cut cross-section or obliquely. So you don't see the beauty of a skeletal muscle cell unless you have a perfect longitudinal cut. And when you do that, you'll see that this muscle cell has some nuclei, labeled N here, and another one here, and one here, not labeled, there's another one here. But what's this nucleus labeled CT? What do you think that belongs to? Connective tissue. Name a cell in the connective tissue. That would be the most prominent cell in connective tissue that would have a nucleus like that. Fibroblast, absolutely. Fibroblast. This fibroblast here is in what? Connective tissue structure. Endomysium, right? Endomysium. So endomysium is this white area here and this pale area here. So this represents one muscle cell, second muscle cell, and the third muscle cell with the endomysium in between. Notice that skeletal muscle cells in longitudinal view have dark and light bands. Dark areas and light areas. Do you remember from A&T class or general biology what the designation is for those dark and light bands from biology training? A band, which one is that? The dark one.
Kim Hartman.
It's a German word, and I forgot my German language for dark. And the I band is the light one, again, a German word for light. So we have alternating dark and light band here. You can look up in the textbook for the original German term you want. But notice up on the screen that that the I band has a line going through there, and there. The I bands have a thin line. Y'all see that? I'll point it out. See it? The I band is that pale area there, and right through the middle of that pale area is a line, which splits the I band into two parts. Those Z lines, as they're called, and there's a German word for in between.
Zwischen.
Zwischen. Zwischen. Zwischen line. The Zwischen line. Zwischen line. And you're not going to see that no matter how hard you try in lab, because the preparations aren't as elegant as this one. Now, you could maybe see it in the best preparation if you used your oil immersion lens, the 100X lens, but you do not do that. I might set up a demonstration, though, so that you can see it. And I'll ask Mark Marston to do that as well, too, to see if we can see these Z lines there. We have to make some sense out of all the A and I bands and Z lines today, so that when you're looking at them in lab, you can be thinking about those things. If we go to the electron microscope, much higher magnification, higher resolution, we can see a nucleus. And there's one there. And so we're looking at an area. In the next picture, we're looking at an area about like that. And we'd only be able to do that with the electron microscope. So there's a nucleus on the edge of the cell. Notice that the nuclei are in fact, on the edges of the cell, right next to the sarcolemma, which is right here, sarcolemma there. What's a sarcolemma? A plasma membrane of muscle. What does sarco refer to? What does myo refer to? Kind of redundant, isn't it? Sarco and myo prefixes for muscle. Let's find the Z lines. There they are. Let's find the Z lines of the light microscope. There they are. Right through the middle of the I band. And there's the I band. There's the A band. Dark A band, light I band. And where are the myofibrils? Where are these small subunits that we saw in the drawing sticking out through the cut end of that cell? Well, let's try and look for them. And they're composed of the same stuff found in the cytoskeleton of almost every cell. Actin and myosin, and a few other things. I don't see these myofibrils very well here. The author seems to think you can see one here. And the author seems to think there's one there. They're running along here like so. But I don't think so. Clearly they're going to be running longitudinally because that's what we saw in the drawing. How about here? A little bit better, but still not very good. There's a myofibril, I guess, running through here. But they're so densely packed, extremely densely packed, that it's very difficult, even with the electron microscope, to find the outline. I think there's one here, myofibril. And each myofibril, let's use this partial one here. Here's the edge of it. Here's the other edge of it. And they're running through here, like so. Each myofibril is made up of end-to-end subunits. Myofibril, subunit of the fiber. What's the subunit of the fibril? Sarcomere. The myofibril reminds me of a freight train. Myofibril reminds me of this 3-mile-long freight train with one box car after the other. Remember when you're driving through North Dakota and you see this 3-mile-long train and one car after another? And when I was studying this, I looked at that train and I saw myofibril instead. And the boxcars were sarcomeres, one right after the other, end to end. Not a perfect model, but not too bad.
On the previous slide, how is there a good way to tell the connective tissue from the nucleus? Is the nucleus always going to be compatible?
The fibroblast nucleus is always much darker.
Much darker.
And generally much flatter.
Yeah. Okay.
The fibroblast nucleus is much darker, much flatter, and the muscle cell nucleus more like a cucumber, and the fibroblast more like a cigar.
Okay.
Cigar versus cucumber. There's plenty of euchromatin, pale stuff in a muscle cell nucleus, but in the fibroblast nucleus, fibrocyte nucleus, not much pale stuff. Mostly heterochromatin there. Okay. So, let's move on. We're in search of myofibrils. prepare the muscle cells in such a way as to osmotically ensure that more water is in them and that the cytosol is more watery. And we can do that by choosing the proper fixative and the proper procedure for fixing them. And so these muscle cells have been artificially, you might say, injected with water, and that moves the myofibrils farther apart. And so in these cross sections, not this view, but that view, the myofibrils are coming out at you. Myofibrils run lengthwise through the cell, and here they're cut in cross section. And so each one of these little dots represents a long freight train running across Montana, North Dakota. The law, and you're just looking at the locomotive coming straight at you there. So let's look at them longitudinally, and still not easy in a cut, but I do see some nice ones there. See those streaks? Myofibrils? There's a lot of nice streaks there. It's just not as elegant as over there. And we're going to spend a whole lot of time now talking about the structure of the myofibril. Here's another preparation, H and E. And I think even in the back of the room, you can see in the best possible preparation where we didn't allow water to enter osmotically, we can still see in an optimal preparation little dots which represent myofibrils coming out at you. Long, stringy fibers, myofibrils. The nuclei are around the outside. There's a good one there, another one there, another one here. These are all nuclei of a single muscle cell. This is connective tissue out here. There's a connective tissue cell there. What are these little tubes cut in cross-section with a star in the center of the tube?
Blood vessels.
Blood vessels. The smallest of blood vessels is called what?
Capillary.
These are cross-sections of little tubes, capillaries, and you'd expect to find a red blood cell. Here's a bigger one. That's an arteriole. That's a bigger one. And that's got a little red cell in it right up there. A little bit of a red cell. But look how tiny they are. If they were collapsed, you wouldn't see them. And so when they are collapsed, it's almost impossible to recognize them in your slides. But we do have plenty of muscle where they remain open, and you can recognize them quite well. This is like a 25x objective lens here, and there's the 40x lens over there, the high dry lens. What's all this tissue called that's in here, which is delicate, thin, fibrillar stuff, but right in here, what is that stuff again?
Endomysium.
And that endomysium contains blood vessels. There'd be some nerve endings in there too, but they're not, they're just so tiny that some of the streaking, in fact, is nerve fibers, and a lot of it's reticular fibers. Endomysium. Question? Yes?
Oh, I was just wondering, in the slides that are going to Mars,
this is probably the most representative
right
here. This is, the previous one is, that's too artificial. That's not typical. Oh, right through here. Okay, we'll talk about that later. Yeah, hold off. Hold off. Call the M line and the H band. One step at a time. All right. let's move on. What do we find in myofibromas? Well, we find proteins that are involved in the contraction process. Some people refer to these long trains of sarcomeres as the functional unit, the smallest functional unit. Other people call the sarcomere the smallest functional unit. I kind of lean toward the sarcomere as being the smallest unit that can provide the individual function of the muscle cell. But these sarcomeres contain, and the myofibrils therefore contain, some little tiny filaments. So let's see what the hierarchy of structure is. Which of these structures is the biggest? The filament? Or the fibril? Or fiber? Which one's the smallest? Filament. Which one's the intermediate size? Fibril. That's the convention used throughout histology. Filament's the smallest. Filaments aggregate to form the fibril. Fibrils aggregate to form the fiber. It's the convention used throughout histology, throughout medicine, and throughout all basic medical sciences. Filament's the smallest. Fibril's the next largest, and fiber's the biggest of all. Whether or not we're talking about collagen fibers, or whether we're talking about muscle fibers, the same convention applies. So when you see thin filaments, you know that these are the smallest units that we'll be talking about. They contain some important proteins that will be discussed far more thoroughly in physiology. Are you not a muscle yet, physiology?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's considerable overlap here now between physiology and histology. And so it'll be a little redundant in some places, but basically the function of this stuff will be covered much more extensively in physiology class. But I still want you to know how these things work, even though we're not going to have such extensive discussions on it. Have you studied the function of these three things yet? Yes or no? Some of you have and some of you haven't, because there's two sections, right?
Yeah.
Okay, some have and some haven't. That's the reason why we have to go, one reason why we have to go through it in here. Well, we're going to look at how actin, troponin, and tropomyosin are arranged structurally, and then maybe talk a little bit about how they actually work during contraction. The other filament inside of the fibril is called thick filament, and it's thicker diameter, thinner diameter, but in a sense, the thick filaments are a little simpler because there's only one principal protein in thick filaments, and that's myosin. So even though they're fatter, they probably are a little simpler in structure. And may seem like a silly question if you haven't studied muscle contraction before. But the question is, do thick filaments make contact with thin filaments? And those of you that have studied a little bit of this, would you say yes or no?
Yes.
I heard the answer.
Yes.
Some of the time, yes. Some of the time. Not all the time. Some of the time. Some of the time they do. Some of the time they don't. When is it that they really make firm attachment, thick and thin filaments? During contraction. When do they make less or no contact? During relaxed muscle. Right. During the relaxed muscle. Good. The myosin heads are little globular units at the ends of myosin molecules. Molecules make filaments. Filaments make fibrils. Fibrils make fibers. So at the end of myosin molecules, we find these globular units that some people call the myosin heads. And these are the units that do what? These are the ones that make contact with the thin filament during what again?
Contraction.
During contraction. And what happens to those myosin heads when they touch and attach to the thin filament? What happens next? They bend or pull, like oars in the water. Just think of that oar as a myosin head, and when it works, it moves. The oar moves and bends. And it's like the oar of the myosin head sticking in the thin filament and moving the thin filament. So we'll draw that. What's the repeating unit of the myofibril? The sarcomere. And the sarcomere includes thick and thin filaments in this unit. Called a sarcomere, which is one boxcar after another on that freight train. So, Ross has a picture of this. It's pretty good. This bundle here is meant to represent a single muscle cell, single muscle fiber, and the outside is the sarcolemma, and the blue is the nucleus. And then, like little worms inside the cytoplasm of that muscle cell, are the very precisely arranged myofibrils. And the myofibrils, this long train here, has three lines that are usually represented by a jagged line, Z lines. And a dark zone here. Let me highlight the dark zone a little bit. Little fish hooks or barbs coming off the thick filament that are the head of the myosin molecules. And I'm not going to draw them for each one of these here, every one of the myosin, every one of the big filaments would have these heads. The question is, how many myosin heads might be on a thick filament? Well, you can figure it out if you knew how many molecules of myosin are in a thick filament. And in humans, the average is 200 myosin molecules. About 200 myosin molecules, approximately, in each thick filament. And each myosin molecule has two heads. So let's see, 200 times 2. 400 maybe myosin heads in a single thick filament. We'll look at a myosin molecule here in a second. But I think this shows an interesting thing. Let's say that this is relaxed muscle, not contracting. The cells are relaxed. There's not very much signal to the muscle cell, and it's not contracting. But now all of a sudden it's going to contract. And what happens to these myosin heads here? Which way will they bend? To the left. Which way will these myosin heads bend?
Right.
To the right. What happens to the thin filaments when the myosin heads here bend to the left and the myosin rows, or is there bend to the right? What happens? The thin filaments slide over one another. Or the thin filaments slide over the thick filament, is what I should say. So here's the thick filament, and there's the Z-line, my little thummies. Fingers are the thin filaments. So tell me what the end result of those myosin head bending is going to be.
Fingers.
My what? My thumbs get closer together. What were they called?
Z-lines.
When the myofibril contracts, the thin filaments move toward the center because the heads on my right side or the thin filaments this way and the myosin heads here row it this way and my Z-lines get closer together. That sarcomere head shortens. One sarcomere shortens and all the rest of them shorten. So they're all shortening, and so that myofibril railroad train here now, when all the Z-lines come together simultaneously, that 3-mile long freight train is now 2 miles long. Like waving a magic wand, abracadabra, and that 3-mile train going across the plains is now only 2 miles long because every boxcar shortened. Every sarcomere shortened. And now I have a smaller train. Well, when all of myofibrils shorten, what happens to the cell? It shortens too, because these are the cytoskeletal elements in the cell. We know, thank goodness you don't need to know, but we know the chemicals that make up everything else. We know that thin filaments have what in them? Actin, troponin, tropomyosin, and we know that the thick filament has myosin. Simple, myosin. And all this shows is what the electron microscopist with the electron microscope sees when the slice is through this region, which is called the H band, where the thin filaments are far apart. What happens to the H band when the sarcomere shortens, do you think? What happens to this band running right through here?
Yes.
It disappears. As the thin filament here and the thin filament here and the thin filament here and the thin filament here touch each other in the midline. And that band is gone. Does the A band change in size? Does the A band change in size when the sarcomere shortens? Here's the A band from there to there.
No.
Does the A band change in size when the sarcomere short?
No.
Does the I band change? Yes. The I band gets smaller. And why? Because this part of the I band here has now moved over here into the A band area. And so the I band gets smaller. And play with it. Make a drawing of the relaxed, and then make a drawing of the contracted, and see if that's all true. Here's the electron microscopic image of a sarcomere from a Z line to a Z line. Here's the length of a myosin molecule, which of course is the width of the A band. There's the thickness of the H band. That's the end of a thin filament. That's the end of a thin filament. And when those thin filaments when those thin filaments, my fingers are the end, when those thin filaments come together, that band disappears. When the Z lines come together, there's a shrinkage in the size of the A band. This diagram is wrong. The myosin molecules are right. The A band is fine. But you see, there's an H band here. So the thin filaments end right here. And the thin filament ends right here. And this thin filament ends here. And that thin filament ends here. So the thin filament should end right here. End right there. And so this is wrong. It's incorrect. I haven't written the author yet, but there's nothing there. They've drawn a... This would be the case. This would be the case when the sarcomere shortens. And this thin filament and that filament touch. But clearly that's not the case because we'd see the H-band. Well, the thin filaments are composed of the following units. This is very cartoonish in nature. It's totally symbolic. But here's a fully assembled thin filament. And what was this representation here? Well, these thinnest little lines. This line here. This line here. Thin filament. So let's look at the symbolic molecular representation of it right here. There's the fully assembled one. And it's composed of a double strand of actin molecules. Actin molecules are globular. And that's called globular actin. But in the fully assembled muscle cell, this actin now changes to fibrous or F-actin. Here it's called G-actin. It's called F-actin because it's fibrous. So these little pearls, like a pearl necklace, where the string is broken and the pearls are falling all over the tabletop, are the actin globular molecules. But when strung together, they form a twisted double strand of pearls or of actin molecules. And tropomyosin wraps in a helical fashion around the thin filament. And the tropomyosin molecule is a specific length, and your textbook gives you that length, and don't bother with it. And the troponin molecules are equally spaced at a particular well-known distance apart. And that's the fully assembled thin filament putting together the tropomyosin molecules, the three subunits of the troponin protein, and the multiple little globular units of the actin molecules. We'll look at this slide, then we'll take a break. So here we got a really nice sarcomere up there. There's an adjacent one over here, and an adjacent one over there. And here the artist in Ross's textbook has drawn one sarcomere, the Z line here with the thin filament attached to the Z line, relaxed muscle. Here's the other end here. And of course, another thin filament there. And then those myosin molecules are interestingly placed, aren't they? They have their double heads only on one end of the molecule. And then the other myosin molecules have a head, double heads as well. But they're strategically located to be able to attach to the little green actins here. In a relaxed muscle, in the H band, are there any myosin heads that contribute to muscle contraction in the H band?
No.
I don't see any. I don't see any myosin heads in here. So in the center of the sarcomere, there's no activity of contraction. There's no myosin heads. So what happens when this myosin head attaches here, and this one attaches here, this one attaches here? What's going to happen next? They bend, and the thin filament moves in a particular direction. In physiology, you might talk about chitin a little bit. That might be useful because that's the little elastic protein that allows that sarcomere to return in a relaxed state. That's the elastic properties of muscle allow that muscle to extend out. And this reminds me of a little coil spring on a car. As you move inwards, the coil spring squeezes together, and as a signal disappears from the nerve, boing, boing, and that sarcomere then extends out. It's part of the elastic property of the muscle cell. Don't worry about alpha actinin, but everything else, tropomodulin, no, not important. So let's take a break. Calcium is stored in here. And as the action potential streams down the membrane of the T-tubule, it causes both of these sacs to puke out their calcium, to regurgitate the calcium out into the side of that. What's that calcium going to bind to, for those of you who studied this already?
Troponin.
It's going to attach to the troponin molecule and initiate muscle contraction. Okay. How do skeletal muscle cells contract then? Well, we talked about it already, but let's see how we did. It's called the sliding filament law. It's not a theory after 100 years here. Everybody believes it, so it's a theoretical. Sliding filament process. What slides? The thin and thick filaments slide over one another. Do the thin filaments get shorter? When my fingers slide over the pen and my thumbs get closer together, do my fingers get shorter?
No.
Does the pen get shorter?
No.
What changes in dimensions? Bands change. The eye band begins to shrink. The A band stays the same length. The eye band gets smaller as the Z lines move closer together. What's the role of myosin? To provide the myosin heads, to provide the oars that bend to move the thin filaments, or in the case of a boat, to move the water, or the boat. What does troponin do? It binds to calcium when calcium is released. And what happens to the troponin, for those of you that know? When calcium binds to it, what happens?
It kind of shifts.
Yeah, the troponin changes its configuration. It's like it ratchets a little bit. And to that troponin is connected the tropomyosin. So it essentially, the troponin and the tropomyosin unit move physically to reveal where the actin can bind to the myosin head. Tropomyosin is essential because in a relaxed muscle, the tropomyosin molecule is in the way. It's obstructing the attachment sites between thick and thin filaments. So if the muscle's going to contract, if the sarcomeres are going to shorten, we've got to somehow move the tropomyosin out of the way so that the myosin can find the actin. Calcium ions are key to contraction. And how can we assure, how does Mother Nature assure that there's adequate calcium available for this whole process? From bone, and what's going to break down the bone to provide calcium for muscle contraction? Osteoclast, and how the osteoclast activated? What hormone indirectly activates osteoclast? Parathyroid hormone. Parathyroid hormone has receptors on osteoblasts. And then the osteoblasts secrete a substance which activates osteoclast. Yeah, that's why we have, another reason why we have bone. We need calcium in our diet for far more than just muscle contraction. Nerves won't work. Blood won't clot. Lots and lots of things. Where is calcium found within the muscle cell? Well, concentrated in the sarcoplasmic reticulum during relaxed state, but then flooding the cytoplasm when it's contracting. It's stored primarily in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but then it's released down to the watery component of the cell, the cytosol. When does calcium attach to troponin? Well, as soon as it's released from its storage bin, then it finds troponin and binds to troponin. And here's a nice simple little model. This is as far as we're going to go in histology. You'll do a whole lot more in physiology, I'm sure. But here, how do we know that this is the relaxed state up here?
Because the myosin
is not bound to the actin. And why can't the myosin head, those little barbs we saw that are bending, why isn't the myosin head firmly attached to the actin? Because the tropomyosin is in the way. And there's the troponin, three parts. So what has to happen is that when calcium binds to troponin, it changes its configuration and its attachment. So the T in attachment to tropomyosin moves tropomyosin out of the way, and voila! The myosin binding site, which was obscured here, now is made available to myosin, and because of some biochemical events, including the breakdown of ATP, that myosin head bends, and this filament moves that way. Here is the ore. There's the ore. And here the ore is bending. And it's attached here. So that means that this thin filament is ored in that direction towards the center of the sarcomere. Okay. What is the communication system then that allows all of this to happen? Oh, by the way, If you look at this model of a muscle cell here, tell me what to do to make this muscle cell more powerful.
More of them.
In fact, we'll find out that we can fire more nerves, which will make more of them contract. So instead of just one contracting, we might get more. to have more neurons firing in our spinal cord. Is there any other way we can make this more powerful?
Harder.
To go to the gym and do what?
Lift weights.
Lift weights. Cause of what? Well, let's say here. Let's say I'm going to pick up this little thing here, and now I'm going to go over here and pick up this right here. And now I'm going to pick this up right here. What's the difference? What's the difference between this and this? What made the biceps stronger in going from there to there? By the way, I didn't work out between. Say muscle cell. So what's the difference? The number of neurons firing. I only have maybe a couple neurons, but we're going to forget about careful summation and all that. The simplest explanation is that here maybe I have a couple neurons firing and one muscle and five muscle cells are contracting. Now I'm going to increase the number of neurons and now I've got hundreds of muscle cells contracting. Just the number of muscle cells. Or I can go out to the gym, and it's going to take more than a few seconds, but I could now have a muscle cell after working out with Arnold from California. I now have a muscle cell that big. And what's this process called of going from the small cell to the big cell?
Hypertrophy.
Remember that was the end of the epithelial lecture, hypertrophy. What's the process when you increase the number of cells in a muscle? You can't do that, though. Hyperplasia. Why can't you increase the number of muscle cells by working out? Why can't I go to the gym and work out for 6 months and have more muscle cells in my biceps? And you were born with a defined number of muscle cells. That's one way. What's another way of saying it? Muscle cells do not divide. No mitosis. No mitosis, no division, means you cannot increase the number of your muscle cells, period. They can heal by a process that we'll talk about in pathology. So there's no hyperplasia in skeletal muscle. But there is hypertrophy. So when the cell gets bigger, explain to me why it becomes stronger. I asked the question wrong. Why does a muscle cell get stronger? And tell me in structural terms, not that God made it that way.
Increase the number of myofibrils.
You're increasing the number of myofibrils. You're increasing, or another way of saying it, you're increasing the number of sarcomeres. You can't get more power from mitochondria other than providing energy for the process. It's true, the mitochondria increase as well. But the reason for the power increase is the more sarcomeres. The more freight trains, the more myofibers. So when Arnold quit lifting, what happened to his muscle cells? Well, they went back to their original state. And why is that muscle cell less powerful now? It has less myofibrils and it has less sarcomeres in it now. Yes. Less myofibrils. Where does this muscle get its signal? What's the pathway called the stimulus pathway? Well, the story begins.
President, I
Steroids. Steroids act like testosterone, and there are testosterone receptors and acts as a growth hormone, an anabolic steroid, testosterone, or any DHT or androstenedione anabolic steroids have receptors on the muscle cell, which changes the gene expression in the cell. And that the nuclei transcribe more messenger RNA, and more messenger RNA transcribes more actin and myosin, and we end up with more sarcomeres and more myofibrils. What's the testes look like in a guy that's taking anabolic steroids? Is there big balls there? It's like little teeth. More anabolic steroids they take, the smaller their testes become. That's because of something in physiology called negative feedback. Okay. Anyway, we're talking about neurons here that are activating these cells. And the cell body is in the spinal cord, in a place that you're going to have to locate this week in lab. And we'll look at a picture in a second. And from this cell body of the neuron comes a long wire, much like the muscle cell itself, a long wire from my spinal cord here through the femoral nerve and down, and I guess the nerve changes name somewhere along that way, and goes all the way to the muscle that lifts up my big toe, whatever that muscle is. Or any of the muscles in the leg, for that matter. How long is that nerve cell? Cell body's up here, and how long is the nerve cell? It's the length of my leg. 1 meter long, one nerve cell. 1 meter long, and its origin is in the spinal cord, and its termination will be on, termination of that nerve fiber will be on the sarcolemma of more than one muscle cell. And up here comes a signal generated up here just above my butt there. And the signal runs down that wire and ends up being transferred to the muscle cell. Depolarization is going to occur. And a new action potential generated. It's going to flow along the surface. And that new action potential dips down into the T-tubule and causes calcium to be released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. We call the action potential sometimes the nerve impulse. The neuromuscular junction is the nerve or neuron muscle transition point. Have you studied what happens there yet?
Yeah.
Some of you have. Acetylcholine is released from the end of the neuron, right here, acetylcholine is released and dribbles across a little space there. And the acetylcholine binds to a receptor. Does that make sense to you, all this stuff we're talking about here? Binds to a receptor on the sarcolemma, and that binding to the receptor opens what kind of channel?
Calcium.
No, right on the cell membrane. When the acetylcholine binds the receptor, what channels are open?
Sodium
channels. Sodium channels open. And what's this process where sodium ions then rush into the cell called?
Diffusion.
Depolarization. And that depolarization signal is conducted or transmitted down the T-tubule. And there's the T-tubules in the sarcolemma, and there's the sarcoplasmic reticulum, so you should know something about this stimulus pathway that started right here above your butt and is running down to the muscle cells all in a single neuron or more. And there's that single neuron. This, we'll talk about tomorrow, hopefully. This cell body here, as it's called, is found in the spinal cord. And this axon here is found in your femoral nerve or your sciatic nerve or your obturator nerve or whatever nerve that it needs to pass through. Here's a neuromuscular junction. Acetylcholine is kept in synaptic vesicles and is relieved and binds to the receptor. That causes sodium to rush in, and this is called the stimulus pathway. It began up in the spinal cord and is finished down in the muscle cell. Maybe it's that muscle is a meter away. What does this picture show here? Does this one neuron end on one muscle cell? No, that's very rare. Not too many places in the body will you find one nerve cell supplying only one skeletal muscle cell. What's this unit called? Where one motor neuron supplies multiple muscle cells. What's that unit called?
A motor
unit. And how might I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. How might I have 14 muscle cells contracting, producing greater strength, rather than just 7 muscle cells contracting? I add another neuron. Another neuron fires, and now I have 14 cells contracting, right? If I add 3 neurons, now I've got 3 times 7. 21 muscle cells contracting, that might be the same. 21 muscle cells contracting. Now I have 3 motor neurons firing. What's going on here? The depolarization wave is passing down the T tubule. It changes the configuration of the voltage sensor. It opens, and that causes calcium to be released out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Well, when a nerve fiber approaches muscle cell, when this nerve fiber, axon in yellow, approaches muscle cell, it branches to a guarantee that multiple muscle fibers are supplied. And this branch here is called a motor end plate. That branch is called a motor end plate. This branch is called a motor end plate. And this motor end plate here, and this motor end plate here, let's do that one. That motor end plate has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, count them, 7 neuromuscular junctions. The question I always get is a motor end plate equivalent to a neuromuscular junction? And the answer is no. Because here's one motor end plate, which represents one branch of the nerve fiber. And this is the motor end plate containing multiple individual neuromuscular junctions. So, here's a motor end plate coming from this branch of this motor neuron here. These are muscle cells in the background. And there are multiple little dark objects, multiple little neuromuscular junctions, which I drew one here, where the branch of the axon indents the muscle cell to form that neuromuscular junction. Motor end plate, but multiple neuromuscular junctions. So it's like this. Here's a motor end plate. And here's an axon coming down to the muscle cell. This is the motor end plate. Right here. Whole thing is the end of that nerve fiber. And how many touches can I make on that muscle cell? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I can make 5 neuromuscular junctions with that muscle cell. 5. You'll be looking at this slide in lab. Here's one neuromuscular junction, like here. And you can see that the nerve fibers coming down from the spinal cord, maybe through the femoral nerve, or it's the only nerve I know, femoral nerve, coming down here. And it's going to touch the surface of the skeletal muscle cell. And if the nerve fires, then these little bubbles release acetylcholine, which diffuses across and attaches to a receptor, which opens sodium channel, causes depolarization of the cell. Here's one motor end plate. Here's another one. There's another one, here's another one, there's another one. And how many touches? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 touches. 8 neuromuscular.
Is that number variable and can it be changed?
Variable. Yeah, that can't be changed as far as we know.
Okay.
Oh, one more thing. Every skeletal muscle cell has a basal anna, just like epithelial cell. Ross calls it the external lamina, but there's no good reason to do that. And so it's only confusing. The basal lamina runs along the surface of the skeletal muscle cell. What happens when you get to the neuromuscular junction? What happens to the basal lamina? It goes up along every single nerve fiber. So tomorrow we'll see that every nerve fiber has a basal lamina too. And here they are continuous with one another. And there's a little bit that goes in here as well, but not much. I wouldn't want to basal lamina in here, because that's a barrier for acetylcholine to diffuse. Basal lamina is glue. I'm not going to stick a bunch of glue in there so that acetylcholine gets stuck in the glue. That's probably not a good thing. There is some in there, though. Okay. Are there different kinds skeletal muscle fibers? It won't take as long to get to cardiac and smooth muscle. That's a short trip. So we'll do that tomorrow, but we've got a little bit left to do here. And one of the questions that's of interest to everybody that works out in the gym or conditions themselves in any way is this question: are every skeletal muscle cell identical? And they are. Some of them are called red muscle cells. That's not equivalent to red meat, by the way. And these red muscle cells are rich in myoglobin, heavily laden with myoglobin, as opposed to the other ones we'll talk about that have very little. What do you think the function of myoglobin might be as you look at its name?
Oxygen.
Oxygen. Why did you say that?
Globin.
Because it reminds you of hemoglobin. So that means that it can bind oxygen. Oxygen for a rainy day. Do you think these red fibers are endurance muscle fibers?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, because why? Because they've stored oxygen for a rainy day. They've stored oxygen. So it might be intuitive that if the muscle cell has the ability to store oxygen, that they can work longer. Endurance runners have conditioned red fibers, especially optimum then for aerobic metabolism, which means that they're loaded with mitochondria. They have a lot of Krebs cycle enzymes. Endurance fibers that contract somewhat slowly for skeletal muscle cells, would we expect to see any mitochondria? Yeah, quite a lot, huh? White fibers. Is there much myoglobin in them? Well, maybe not, because they look whiter. Are these cells designed to use the Krebs cycle? They're low in mitochondria. What do you think?
No.
No? Krebs cycle enzymes are lower in amount. And so how do they make ATP? By glycolysis. However, they can store glucose. That's a darn good thing. They have to store a lot of glucose because when they metabolize glucose, they only make 2 ATP for every glucose molecule. Up here, this cell makes 36 ATP for every glucose molecule. So the red fibers can make a whole bunch of ATP. But the white fibers, they have to store glucose. These fibers get most of theirs from the bloodstream. Are these fibers good for endurance?
No.
No, these are the big powerful muscle cells that we see in weightlifters that are not known for endurance running. And they are very fast reaction fibers. Here they're stained to show, and really you can't really see red and white distinction unless you use some kind of special stain. Enzymes are being stained. So here's the red fibers and there's the white fibers. So here's 1, 2, 3, 4 white fibers. Here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 red fibers. This motor neuron we looked at, do you think that motor neuron supplies both of it? No. That motor neuron supplies only white muscle cells or red muscle cells, and never the twain shall meet. Never the twain shall meet. So we can't convert, therefore, we can't convert white fibers to red fibers, and we can't convert red fibers to white fibers. They cannot be converted by conditioning. Okay, I guess we'll finish up with muscle in the first hour of tomorrow, and then we'll move on to nerves, which probably won't be anything to do the following week. As you leave,
can I actually get an extra one?
Yeah. The answer is no.
Yes.